Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this June 30th, 2018, with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. See, I thought I'd throw that extra thing in there to see if you were on your toes. And
I'm not. I'm on my tail.
Yeah, I can do it. Well, you were your metaphorical toes is what you're on.
It starts with a T.
Metaphorical toe? Well, toes.
My metaphorical tail, which I don't have a tail either. It's, you know, I'm sitting on it.
Well, you have a residual tail. It's called your coccyx.
A coccyx.
Coccyx.
Yes.
A coccyx.
Yeah.
Cock seven would be a longer one?
Yeah, I think so.
Anyway, you're welcome to give us a call in here if you want to talk about anything economic or to do with investing. Or have any questions about such questions about such questions about such? Oops,
Got stuck in a loop.
773-1400. Of course, the area code here in Central Texas is 254. This is June 30th, so we're live and in living sound today. And if it's not June 30th where you are, you can call you want to, but we probably won't answer the phone. Hey, the Congressional Budget Office came out with a long term budget outlook this week. And we have a caller on 773-1400. So we'll go to the caller first, and then we'll come back to the Congressional Budget Outlook.
Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of discussion the last couple of months about the trade wars. How in the past, how have trade wars ended? Is it something simple or something complex?
All right, thanks.
Trade wars.
Trade wars end very, very slowly.
Let me put it this way. We got in a trade war with Japan, and Japan, because of a cultural difference, and this is still true today about
Asian, heard the word war in trade war.
They consider trade wars and physical wars to be identical behavior, so they considered attacking Pearl Harbor, or for that matter, the Philippines.
A retaliation.
To be
not unprovoked.
Right. And actually, an embargo is considered under United Nations resolutions an act of war. So it is the last time we got into serious prolonged trade wars, they ended with World War II.
Yeah, we got into the trade war during what became the Great Depression. So the Smoot-Hawley Acts came into place, and they spread from us to the rest of the world, very much like what's happening right now. The rest of the world took up retaliatory tariffs against us. At that point, you know, we were coming out of World War I. We had just flexed our muscles. We had gone through the Roaring Twenties and had even more muscles. And then the crash happened, and Congress said, we're going to save some of our jobs, even though the technology that caused the jobs to disappear is technology that we created. The tractor, the automobile.
The truck.
The truck. The automation of things that was going on, it was taking away the farmer's job by replacing 20 farmers with one farmer in a tractor, and now there's no farmer in that tractor. And so this concept of the technology did it, so we're going to say that the rest of the world is taking our jobs. They're able to produce things for less money than we are because they're subsidizing, and in many cases that could be true. Then the response is we're going to smack some tariffs in place, and then the long term is that the Marshall Plan is when we lightened up on tariffs, and then it wasn't really until free trade agreements started that we really ended the trade war that started in the Great Depression.
If you want something to be anxious about, I'll give you a big picture that certainly is low probability right now, but it's an interesting parallel. There was a concerted effort during the debates leading up to the Smoot-Hawley Act, where we put tariffs on everything, to return, and they didn't use the term at the time because supply chain wasn't even a term used at the time, but to return the supply chain to the United States, which is what the debate is about today. In other words, right now when you buy an automobile in the United States, the supply chain goes in and out of the United States sometimes multiple times.
Sometimes lots of multiple times.
So some of that car is being made in Canada, some of them being made in China, some is made in Mexico, and it all comes together here.
Some in Taiwan and Thailand.
And it gets sold here. And that's a very efficient way of doing things because there are places that do things better than other places. And that causes disruptions in the labor market. Now, does it cause a loss of jobs? No. We are at full employment, so I don't see how anybody can say it's causing a loss of jobs.
Well,
now,
temporarily, it causes a loss in jobs. If they're closing a plant here to open one in China to do relatively the same thing, which there's not a lot of that, just as a side note. Usually you open a plant when you have a new piece of technology.
Well, it doesn't actually cause a loss of jobs. It causes a shift in jobs, because when the jobs disappear in one place, they appear in another, and more of them, at least all through history, have appeared in another place. But that means people have to move. And they don't want to move. And they get upset because the thing they've been doing all their life isn't here anymore, whether it's working on the farm behind a plow that is pulled by a mule, or driving a tractor, or working on an assembly line at Ford. They get upset about that. And they vote, and they put a Congress in place that says, we got to fix this, and we go to fix it. The problem is, beggaring your neighbor doesn't work. It just creates a lot of animosity and a net loss across the board. That's what history teaches us. Now, throw in one thing that's in the Washington Post today. Now, I can only tell you it's in the Washington Post, and they claim that they have sources in the Pentagon, and I was able to validate what happened in the White House there, but I don't know anything more than that. And that is that in the White House about a month ago, the president, realizing that we have 35,000 troops in Germany, and Germany's not spending enough, in his opinion,
On its own defense,
and it probably isn't, said, let's bring them home. No, so
it's not that they probably aren't. They agreed when they signed on to NATO to spend 2% of their GDP on defense, and they haven't. We've complained about this for decades on this program.
There's a legitimate issue there. But the response of the president, whether you like it or not, was we should probably bring those troops home. He made speeches to that effect.
During the campaign and after.
Mm-hmm. And he says NATO is an outdated alliance. Well, now the Pentagon is actually drawing up plans to bring all the troops from Germany home.
Let's be clear here. While we've complained and we agree Germany's not doing what it needs to do, the reason why we have troops there is because when history speaks, when we don't have troops in Europe, they go to war with each other.
and the whole idea following World War II is a major strategy. Number one, keep the European nations relatively economically healthy. Let's not have another depression, because depressions lead to dictators, lead to wars. Number two, keep our troops in Europe, because if we're going to fight a war, let's fight it there and not here. And this is a strategy that has been a guiding strategy through every administration and every Congress since World War II. We appear to be abandoning that strategy in two ways. Number one, we have set ourselves, and this is not my opinion, this is the actual actions and statements from the White House, we have set ourselves in a position where we consider Europe and Canada, for example, for that matter, to be strategic threats to the United States. That's the law under which the tariffs are being imposed. And they've been told, you're a strategic threat to the United States. Germany exports a lot of cars to the United States, and they're currently under investigation by the administration under a strategic threat tariff law to determine if their car exports to the United States constitute a strategic threat to the United States. And if so, we'll put a 25% tariff on German autos that are being exported. So we're putting ourselves in an interesting position where we're reversing the strategy
that kept world wars away.
Right. We've gone a long time without a world war. We went all the way through the Cold War without a world war, and largely because of a very successful strategy to do two things. One, keep our troops someplace else to fight wars.
And open up trade barriers
right.
as much as we possibly can, anywhere we possibly can, because if we're dependent on each other for trade, we're not going to go to war with each other.
Well, the president's right. It's costing us money to keep troops in Europe. Of course, it would also cost us money to keep troops here. Germany pays for about a third of the cost of keeping the 35,000 troops in Europe that we keep there. And, if we brought them home, then Germany would be hurting, and we'd still have to pay for keeping the troops here, because we'd have to expand facilities here or get rid of part of our troops.
And we'd have to pay the extra third that Germany was paying. We would have to pay for that.
And I understand his point of view. They're not spending enough money. But I also, it's an interesting point. Now, whether you agree with it or don't agree with it, we're returning to isolationism, and this is exactly what went on in the 1920s, and what's called government-controlled mercantilism.
I believe in free markets. When the government gets involved and says we're going to impose extra expenses, it's always, doesn't matter which government does it, the claim is always it's protecting our workers. Here's the difficulty. It's the same thing that I complained about under the Obama administration. So people don't think that I am, what about them? What about them? You know, let's go back to this and say, under the Obama administration, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did some pretty massive fines on banks. Banks that deserved to be fined. They were doing bad things. So just like these tariffs are being put on countries that in many cases deserve to be fined, the money from the fines that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was charging did not go to the people that were hurt by the bad practices. It went to funding the Bureau and consumer education, which is about as worthless a thing as you can possibly. It's like a public service announcement. That's what they're spending the money on. I think it would be much better to give money to the people that were hurt by the bank as compensation for their difficulty than to waste it on government stuff. When we're talking about tariffs to protect jobs, where does the money from the tariff go? It goes to the government coffers, which they can spend on other things. So what you have is a government getting involved in trade with the purpose of saving jobs. And let's just be really clear here. There are injustices happening, and the government does need to get involved at times to do this. But to do it unilaterally is exactly what you were saying, going back into government mercantilism.
Secretary Ross, who, in case you don't know who Secretary Ross is,
Wilbur Ross,
who is the
sorry, I shouldn't make fun of a name.
Secretary of Commerce.
Just, I can't help it. Mr. Ed had a lasting influence on me.
On Wednesday, he said the domestic steel prices, which have risen about 50%, have risen more than was justified by the 25% tariff. Well, it works that way in economics.
That's how markets work.
And a quote from him, what has been happening is a very unsatisfactory thing, he said. He said it is clearly the result of antisocial behavior.
That's how markets work.
Well, here's my point. This is the kind of thing that you hear out of Russia and China. And this is another interesting point. He was queried about the damage that's being done to individual companies that may very well go out of business because of the steel tariff and the rise in the cost of steel because we're no longer competitive. And Jake was talking about the fact there's one nail company left in the United States, and because nails do not have a tariff on them, but steel does, the U.S. nail company is likely to go out of business unless it gets an exception.
Right, because all the companies that you go to, Ace Hardware or Home Depot, if you order them online, you go to Lowe's, doesn't really matter. If you show up at the store and there are two boxes of nails that look identical to each other and one costs 50% more than the other, which one are you going to buy?
Interesting point, and this is where my objection really comes in. He can have his opinion. Everybody can have their opinion. The tariffs may be good or bad, but here's what I object to. There are 20,000, get this, about 20,000 companies who have requested an exemptions,
yeah,
from the steel tariffs because it will cause them to go out of business. These are U.S. companies with employees in the United States. So far, the Commerce Department has approved 98 of them. In other words, what we have in the United States today, whether we like it or not, is the federal government determining whether manufacturing companies in the United States get to stay in business or don't stay in business. That is centralized mercantilism where the government controls who gets to function and who doesn't. By the way, it's what functioned in Germany. In the 1930s, once the National Socialists took over, they determined which businesses got government favors and which didn't, and which ones paid tariffs and which one didn't.
This is the same problem that I see and that many of our listeners hear in the tax code when there are lobbying and special interest groups that get to go to a Congress and say, I want a loophole in the tax code. Congress then makes a loophole for one particular business, and they get kind of a guaranteed vote in the future. that's not the way that we should be doing business as far as free enterprise goes. And there's a way of approaching this to say, first off, the nature of the tariff needs to be clearly explained. It isn't right now. It's based on strategic interest, but it hasn't clearly said why a country should get an exemption and another one shouldn't. And it also hasn't clearly said why one company can get an exemption and another one doesn't. It's a whim of the person giving the exemption. Now, we need to clarify that a bit.
Let me make a point here. I'm not being a Democrat. This is in testimony before Congress is when Wilbur Ross made these statements, and Chuck Grassley, who's an Iowa Republican and a conservative, he said, could I make an observation after hearing all that? It sounds to me like we've got a government-run mercantilist economy as opposed to a free market economy.
Sounds like he's done some research there.
It's a form of socialism. It's a form of the government determining by who offers political support to the government. By the way, I don't have any solid evidence. I don't think anybody does. But it's noted that if the company made significant contributions to the Trump campaign and was very much a supporter of Trump, they appear to be getting the exemptions from the tariffs. And the ones who have made statements otherwise, I've been told, fire your CEO and maybe you'll get some relief.
So there's a problem here. Whether or not tariffs are right, we can look at this. And you've heard some excitement in us over the tariffs, by the way, just to kind of recap that. We haven't had the ability to measure the effect of a tariff since during the Great Depression. I mean, the measurement, the fact that Wilbur Ross is saying when he says that the price of steel, of hot rolled steel, is
too high.
It went up way above what was necessary with the tariff. The reason for that is, before the tariffs were in place, we created about 77% of our own steel. That's a lot of our own steel, but it's not anywhere near as much as we would like to have. That could be a strategic threat to our nation. There's a deeper strategic threat. You've heard us talk about it in that we don't mine any of our own aluminum. We don't mine our iron mining to create steel is non-existent.
We import all of our alumina, which is a processed bauxite.
Right. So when you go back to that and you say, that's the real strategic threat, how do we fix that? If we just put a tariff on it, we're still not creating any of our own. So instead we put it on the finished aluminum and the finished steel, which it's a questionable way of doing this. When we put a 25% tariff on steel and we create our own 77% of what we are making, so we've got 23% imports coming in. You got a 25% tax on those 23% of what we make. Okay, so 25% tax on that. Why would all steel prices go up 50%? Well, number one, because we're not...
But only in the United States.
But only in the United States.
They actually declined in the rest of the world.
Right. Only in the United States. The reason is because it costs more to buy the imported steel. So people go to a domestic steel manufacturer and they say, I want to buy your steel. The domestic manufacturer says, we don't have enough steel to go around, so we're going to have to raise our prices. So they raise their prices, but the demand is higher than 25% because a lot of that 23%, the imported side of things, stopped. The manufacturers overseas said, whoa, we're not going to be competitive if we send this over there. So they stopped. So we have less than 23% imports happening suddenly, which means that we have a shortage of steel. If you have a shortage of steel, expect steel prices to go up. That's not animosity. It's not antisocial behavior. It's supply and demand. We have a low supply and the demand has not dropped. Prices go up. That is simple economics. This is economics at a level that anybody that's even read the beginning of it, supply and demand, we've limited supply. Demand is still there. In fact, we're at a peak in demand where there's a lot of building that's trying to happen right now. And there's not enough steel to go around. So saying all of that, it's not surprising that we have a massive increase in the price. The same happens, just as a side note, over a longer period of time if you increase income taxes on an oil company. Expect the price of oil to go up. And it may go up more than the tax that was put on the oil company, because you've just put in a layer of inefficiency that costs more than just the tax.
And that's the thing about economics. It gets complicated. But I said earlier, we're going to talk about Congressional Budget Office projections.
Yes, yeah.
They came out with what economists have already been saying, but they made it more or less official. And the bottom line to it is, we in the United States have chosen to dramatically increase our governmental spending and cut taxes. Now, by the way, this is the interesting thing to me in looking at the CBO's document, which you can actually go to their website and get it. The percentage of the loss in revenue to the government from the corporate income tax cut is tiny. The general tax cut to the public is where the big hit is occurring as far as revenues to the government is concerned. We certainly enjoy paying less taxes, but the government is getting less, and it's borrowing more, and interest rates are going up. This all coming together, they basically say, if we don't change the law, now that means in 2026, the law reverts to the old tax law, except on corporate, but we will develop enough of a deficit head of deficit, meaning like a head of a
steam.
Flood
it's
or
like
steam
building
in
up
a
pressure.
River, by 2026, that 30 years from now, we will be spending a third of our gross domestic product on government, and about half of that will be on interest payments on the national debt. In other words, and by the way, the interest payments on the national debt, according to the CBO report, if nothing changes, will run up to be very close to our total budget today in 30 years if we change nothing. Now, is that going to happen? Frankly, I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is we're going to get a recession sometime between now and then, and it will worsen considerably.
We're good at dealing with crises.
Well, you say we're good at crises. It. Here's where we may repeat history. As we went into what became the Great Depression, we had a stock market crash. We had a recession crank up, and it could have just been a recession. Congress saw that we were spending too much money and not getting enough tax revenue, so they raised taxes and cut spending.
That's called austerity. That's how the Europeans tried to get out of the Great Recession, and they didn't work. We had a more thought-out approach this time around, and it worked for us. But we came out of the recession before anybody else did.
This is the if we want to have a concern, this is it. As we get close to the 2020s, we're doing such a wonderful job of repeating the fiscal mistakes of the 1920s, it's downright fascinating from an economics point of view and scary from a personal point of view. We are becoming isolationist. We are cutting taxes, as we did, by the way, in the 1920s. We're seeing inflation start back up. We're seeing interest rates start back up.
Then we hit immigration. Immigration is an issue that, if we had had this conversation 4 years ago with Republicans only, the vast majority of Republicans would say immigration is a necessary thing. We've got to have some. That's not the party platform at the moment. The party platform at the moment is stop it until we can stop the illegal immigration. That's a very bad move, economically speaking, just because we don't have enough jobs to go around. I mean, we don't have enough people to fill all the jobs. And if we cut off the people at the same, you have the same effect when you cut off steel as you cut off people, supply and demand again. That means that wages are going to go up, and people go, well, that's great. That sounds fantastic. People get raises. It's true, except that prices have to go up to pay for those raises. So we're going to have inflation. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Thank you. You're kind of scaring me. I've got about $650,000 invested in some one of these companies like Raymond James. Oh, that's not it. I don't want to say it because.
But don't say it.
My neighbors. But I'm concerned that you're talking about recession. You're talking about.
Well, there's. Not anytime soon. We're talking a recession 2 years out.
Do you take Barron's, by the way?
Do I take what?
Barron's. The newspaper that comes out on Saturday.
No, I don't even know where it is.
Well, just go to Barron's.com and look at their headline, and you'll see we're not. I love it when the big minds and we start saying something, and about 3 weeks later, all the big minds in the world listen to the show, and they say the same thing. But the fact that a recession is coming is now becoming, barring some major change that I don't think. Either Congress or the president is all interested in doing. A recession in 2020 is more and more and more baked into the effects. Now, can you market time your way out of that? No, I don't think so. No one's ever been successful at it so far. Let's put it like this. So the thing to do,
or not repeatedly.
sometimes people get lucky, but the next time around they blow up. But the point is, there are ways to structure a portfolio, and certainly Morningstar has been discussing this a lot recently, as have others, and we certainly work at it. There are ways to structure a portfolio with the knowledge that there is likely going to be a recession coming. But I can tell you, we've gone so long without a recession.
Even if we didn't have this stuff going on, we're due for a recession soon anyway. Recessions are normal. There's something that typically happens every 5 years or so. We've gone 10 years without one.
Yeah, we had a real knockdown, drag him through the mud, kick him in the face recession.
And that's what part of the fear is from, because we expect that again. It's not going to be like that.
Which is what's called a secular recession, a really nasty one, and we won't get one of those again probably for a long time, probably not till about 2030. But meanwhile, back at the ranch, we're due for a cyclical recession, and we're going to get one. I'm quite confident, unless the laws of economics get repealed by God or somebody. The president cannot repeal the laws of economics. At least I don't think he can. So what the fact is, if your portfolio, if whoever is running, whoever is managing your portfolio at not Raymond James, says, okay, here is why we have this position in the event of a cyclical recession. Here's exactly our plan of action, and here's how we're going to benefit from it. Then, and has thought about it strategically and can show you historically that this would have worked, well, then you're probably in pretty good shape. If not, I'm of the opinion, with $650,000, you can probably find an independent registered investment advisor who isn't working for a major corporation. And there's a fundamental issue here. There's a place for the Raymond James and the Edward Jones and so on of the world, and that is for the smaller investor, because they charge some pretty high costs to be there, and they work for a corporation, and they get their health care from a corporation. I could go all into that. But they're working for a corporation. Once you get to the point where you can afford to hire an independent, fee-only fiduciary who will solely work for you and have no conflicts of interest by working for somebody else, like a corporation, it is our opinion that is a good way to go, because that person's well-being is not dependent upon their favor from their superiors at whatever brokerage firm. Their well-being is dependent upon your approval of what they do, and they generally get managed. They generally get compensated by assets under management, so that if your assets drop, so does their income, and that puts you on the same side of the table. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, let me throw this thing in here too. Just as when we're talking about this, you know, and I know, caller, that the market goes down. How many times has it gone down while you've had a portfolio in the market?
Pretty often.
Right. So,
when I was actually working, I paid little attention to it.
Yeah. Okay. So this concept here is recessions happen and the market goes down. If you don't have a plan in place for when it happens, if somebody's telling you, well, if we have a recession or if the market goes down, that's not a good methodology. You got to look at history and say these things happen. They're a normal part of our economic cycle. So you shouldn't be surprised by a normal part of the economic cycle. You can't predict them to the day. You can't predict them even to the quarter. But you can say they're going to happen. If they're going to happen, what's our plan in place for dealing with it when it does?
At least concept. Go ahead.
The word recession has never been in our conversation.
Well, I will. There's very few things I can predict with near certainty. And I can predict with a great deal of confidence that at some point we are going to have a recession, A. B, it's going to follow right after a period where everybody thinks we're not going to have a recession. Because that's the way they always do.
That's the way recessions work.
And particularly if you're in retirement and you're drawing income off the portfolio, that's not something I am of the opinion you should ignore. It's like saying
you shouldn't wait to plan for it until it happens. You should plan for it in advance.
Here's the easiest way to understand that for me, because I grew up in an agricultural environment. Droughts, we're in Texas. Droughts happen in Texas. Floods happen in Texas. If you're going to have a successful farm, you need to have a drought plan. How are you going to handle staying in business if we go 3 or 4 years with practically no rain? How are you going to handle staying in business if it just rains cats and dogs for 3 or 4 years? Because you know that happens here in Texas. And the same thing is true in an investment portfolio. You look back at history and you say, okay, we have these big recessions where the market drops 50%. And what would I do when, not if, when that occurs and I'm drawing money out? Do I have a plan for that? Do I have a plan to get through it with while minimizing the damage? And the other thing is, and this is just as dangerous, and I think we're about to see it in the not very far distant future, probably on the other side of the 2020 recession. What happens when we have a runaway bull market like we had in the 1990s? Do I have a plan to stay out of the mania? Because those are the two things that are most damaging to a portfolio. One is participating in a mania, and Bitcoin, we talked about earlier, was a mania. And the other one is panicking and bailing out during a downturn. And if you've got a plan and you've thought it through and you've discussed it and you said, hey, this is our plan of action when this happens. Again, let me throw another. If you lived in California, if you lived in Los Angeles or San Francisco, and you did not have a plan for when the big one comes, you'd be crazy.
Yeah, except most people don't have a plan for it.
If I lived on Galveston Island, I would have an evacuation plan to get out of there when a hurricane was on the way in. You don't wait until the hurricane hits and try to figure out how to evacuate because it's too late.
Well, Google Maps said to take this dirt road right here. I'm going to be going. So the idea here is to treat this like any other business. If you intend to be financially independent, then this is the business that's going to fund your financial independence. You should probably have a business plan. And you don't only plan for the good times. Even though, on the whole, throughout the history of the United States, the good time has been the norm and the bad time has been the abnormal, the bad times still happen. And we plan on the combination of both the good and the bad. That's part of having a fiduciary talk to you about it, is because they've got to look out for your best interest. They've got to figure out how you react in a down market before the down market happens.
And you guys do that, right?
We do.
We make a sincere effort to do that. We are, by the way, and I'll plug us here, we are fiduciaries. We are ERISA fiduciaries, which means that we literally get rid of the conflicts of interest. We don't just disclose them away. And we're independent. I don't know whether you're fit for what we do or you like what we do, but and some people don't. Some people want to play with their money, and we don't play with money.
I don't want to play with my money. In fact, my goal was when I set this account up when I retired, I simply said, I don't care if I make a nickel on this, but I don't want to lose any.
Well, then you need to be in a bank.
Yeah.
See, that's another reason you wouldn't fit with us. The markets go up and down, and we can,
I can't. I don't think I can put it in the bank. If I put it in the bank, then I got to pay taxes on.
Well, let me explain
something.
You
can put an IRA in the bank.
If you have a retirement portfolio, and there's a rule of thumb that's pretty good, over an extended period of time, a well-balanced retirement portfolio should get about inflation plus 4%. And if that's your goal, you're probably in pretty good shape. And that's, by the way, why a good retirement portfolio back in the 1990s typically got 10%. Now, I'm not talking about the stock market. That it averaged around 12. I'm talking about a retirement portfolio with some cushion in it. We got about 10%. Well, we had 6% inflation plus 4% in the plus 4% gain every year.
When you say we, when we say we, we're talking about the United States.
Yeah,
we're not talking about specific portfolio.
Yeah, we're talking about collectively pension funds that are well managed around the country. So if you set by the way, you need to have a goal, and you say inflation plus this much is my long term goal. Now, if you say inflation minus a little bit, so I can put it in the bank or I can put it in municipal bonds or something, then okay, then you're willing to lose a little bit of money every year, then that's fine too. But it's important that you plan for good times, you plan for bad times, and you have a clear goal as to what your long-term expected return is going to be relative to inflation.
Well, if somebody came to your office and looking for advice, And like you said, they may not actually like what you do, or they may like what you do. But if a person came looking for advice and then ended up not liking what you do, what would that be so bad?
No, just go someplace else. I don't have any problem. We sometimes even recommend places for them to go, you know, because, you know, if you want to, there's only a certain number of people who are willing to follow the science of portfolio management, and we follow it rigorously. You know, it's kind of like I employed an engineer to build a house once, and the engineer, I asked why there weren't more residential engineers, and he says, because most people don't like us. They want to build their houses in ways that are engineering, from an engineer's point of view, are unsound, and eventually they're going to fall down, and they don't like us.
And I'll throw this in there, because it sounds like where you were going with that question. When we talk to new people that are coming in, we generally have 3 or 4 appointments before any papers are signed where we discuss at length our philosophy, ask lots of questions, figure out the method that we're going to use to create a plan. So that's, you know, we're not going to be charging money to somebody who doesn't take our advice. Simple as that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's and there's no bailout fees, by the way, with us. We actually refund money usually when people leave. They don't leave very often, but when they do, we give them money back.
If they do it at the right time of the month.
Yeah.
I've been hearing something on the radio talking about if you invest with them, you go up when the market goes up, but you never come down.
That is baloney.
That sounds like BS.
Yeah.
I know what they're talking about, and basically you lose so much money on the front end. It's basically they're talking about an indexed annuity where your surrender charge is so huge that you never lose money unless you take money out, but if you take money out, you lose money.
I'm going to say something controversial here. We got some commercials to play, but I'll say this. If somebody tells you you have $10,000 in your account, but you say, all right, then let me have the $10,000, and they say, no, you can only have $9,000.
But you didn't lose money.
But you didn't lose money, and you say, well, what happened to the other $1,000? Well, that's your charge for liquidating.
I would call that a loss.
I would call that a loss, and that's what vast majority of indexed annuities have, a massive surrender charge. So when they're telling you what your balance is, it's based on a figment of their own imagination. They can tell you never lose money on this figment over here. See, it's still just exactly the same. In fact, it's up now.
Matter of fact, that's one of the things we object to, is when your statement says the money's there, unless you want to take it, in which case it's not there.
Then it's not really there.
The other thing about those deals is you're in essence placing all of the money that you place in one of those deals in a single company and making a bet that 30 years from now that company will still be healthy. And I think that's speculation, right, but that's beside the point.
In case you were wondering, we don't like those indexed annuities at all.
I didn't really like them either, and I didn't think they made any good sense.
Well, they make a lot of sense.
Tonight, but it wasn't last night. And I'm really, truly not very smart about what you do. I was pretty smart about what I did to make it, but I'm really not. But I know you have commercials to do, and I'm going to close our conversation by saying you will be talking to me in the future.
Look forward to it. We'll find out what you did, and I'll probably learn something from you. So you are listening thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
And you are listening to the Person Wealth Coach, and we do have commercials to play.
We'll be back on the other side
with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Hey, I got an anniversary for you.
Oh, what's that?
20 years ago. Have you ever heard of Dish, Texas?
I'm sure I've seen it on a map.
Well, you need to know where Dish, Texas is, and you need to know what happened 20 years ago this month.
Okay, tell me.
They drilled an oil well.
Oh, yeah, the first fracking well.
Yep.
Yeah.
And this engineer had this idea. His name was Schlesberger. He called it his slick water frack. By that last chunk in there. He had this idea, if you pump some chemicals that made water extra wet, combined with sand into shale.
As an abrasor.
Yeah. Into shale that would, so when the rocks cracked apart.
It lets the petroleum out.
The water would cause the rocks to crack apart and put cracks in the shale, and then the sand would hold the shale apart. Because when you drill into sands, into oil sands in Texas, you get a lot of oil out of there because the oil can flow through the sands and you get to pull it up and you make a lot of money.
It's permeable.
It's kind of like the Permian Basin. When they drill into shale, there's oil there, but you can't get much oil to come out of the ground because the shale will not allow the oil to flow through it. So he had this brilliant idea, and he got somebody to help him. He got a company to back him. And the next thing you knew, he was pumping oil out of the ground. Now, we've gotten one heck of a lot better at that since then, but a revolution started 20 years ago in June in Dish, Texas. And by the way, 20 years later, we in the United States now are pumping more oil out of the ground per month than either Russia, who was in number one, or Saudi Arabia, who was number two. Now,
we are in the lead as far as countries. We're not ahead of OPEC. OPEC is a group of countries.
But as a nation, we are the largest oil producer on the planet. Now, we do have a problem, though. And that's why you see oil has gone up to like $74 a barrel, West Texas Intermediate.
Yeah, $74.25.
The problem is we're out of trucks. Well, we ran out of pipeline some time ago.
Ran out of train cars. Now we're out of trucks.
And so we, despite the fact, and what's happening, and you're going to see prices at the gas pump go up. This is one of those things you're going to see economics in action. The Trump administration is cutting off Iran much faster than when Obama's administration put sanctions against Iran. And as a result, you're going to see the price of oil ratchet up pretty significantly as Iran no longer can produce oil into the world system because the Trump administration has made it pretty clear that in a very short order, if a company is doing business with Iran and buying oil from them, they can't do business with the United States.
Which is difficult because Turkey's just opened up a big pipeline to Iran. They just spent a lot of money opening that pipeline.
And so we're cutting a lot of oil out of the system. Now, whether or not that's strategically a good idea, I'm not qualified to comment on. But I am going to say that because of that event, we have this great opportunity for U.S. oil producers to make a lot of money, except the promised infrastructure investment that was necessary to grow. By the way, that's why President Trump promised $1 trillion worth of infrastructure investment. Both sides did. So did Clinton. Was because in order for the United States to grow at anything above about 1.8 to 2% a year, we need more and larger infrastructure to move goods and services around the United States. We just don't have it at this point. We are hitting the wall on trucks. We've already hit the wall on pipeline capacity. We've hit the wall on railroad capacity.
This means that
there's going to be a price to pay down the road.
Right. This is something during the Trump campaign, he talked about this. So did the Clinton campaign. It was one of the major promises that was similar across both campaigns that we needed to get our infrastructure spending up because we had to fix bridges. We had to improve roadways. We had to put in more railroads. We've got to train people to use the different things. It was a big deal. Well, Congress made the decision, and the Trump administration to some extent has not pushed this. They've got other things that they're pushing. to give the tax cut instead of the infrastructure bill. Mm-hmm. The infrastructure bill would have been a really expensive bill. Well, so, mm-hmm. I mean, we're complaining about debt, and now we want the government to spend more money, which sounds a little bit ludicrous, but if you look at direct investment and how it returns, direct investment in education or in infrastructure gives a monumental return later on down the road. You can see it in your own established home. If, for instance, a 16-year-old came into some investment office and the investment person said to the 16-year-old, if you invest $60,000 over the next 4 years, you're going to get $60,000 a year for the rest of your life. I think the scam alerts would start going off and people would say this is unreasonable. There's no way this could happen, well, except I just described a college education.
Well, how about if the market goes up, your investments go up, but if it goes down, you don't lose any money.
Right. That's a scam.
Okay.
It's a scam that is still legal, but it is a scam. Now, when it comes to education, when it comes to infrastructure, if you increase the infrastructure, you allow businesses to use it, then you get growth in the economy. If you give a big tax cut, you also can get growth in the economy. Don't get us wrong there. When people said you said this wasn't going to make the economy grow, that's not what we said. What we said is it wouldn't get tax revenue to grow. Very different. When you give a tax cut to the economy is going to grow. Whether it grows enough to grow the revenue in taxes is something that at this point last year we were looking and saying that's not possible. So the debt was there. So anyway, infrastructure is important.
I've been asked on several occasions by people when I complain about the tax cuts, what would you have done? And my answer is, instead of having a $1 trillion tax cut, I would have taken the $1 trillion promised to infrastructure and maybe through tax cuts. Again, for instance, provide a tax incentive to build more oil pipelines, provide a tax incentive to train truck drivers or build spend more money on making more highways. In other
words,
basically,
it's a good way to magnify the spending. Yeah.
When the United States economy is approaching its maximum capacity, in my opinion, you don't generate more orders and more sales because we're already at maximum capacity. The smart thing to do is to take the revenues that are coming in, invest them back into that economy in such a way that our capacity goes up. Any good business, when it reaches its maximum capacity or it approaches its maximum capacity for making stuff and selling it, would not go out there and then lower prices to get more orders.
Right.
What we just did in the United States economy was say we are producing and exporting and doing everything we can at about maximum capacity, so let's cut prices so we'll get more orders.
The problem with that is we're still at maximum capacity, so the demand may go up, but now you can't keep up with the demand.
A good business instead would say, let's build more plants, let's build more machines, let's
buy
go
more
into
trucks.
More, buy more trucks, get into more automation, do training on our employees so that we can continue to grow. You can get a surge, just like a company can get a surge in its earnings one quarter by cutting employees and doing things like Jack Welch did at GE when it was the largest company in the world and operating at maximum capacity, and he started cutting his better-paid employees out, or IBM did the same thing.
Now, let's jump in here really fast and say something very clearly. Don't hear us being Democrats here, because if the president had gotten his tax bill through, the simplified one, it would have been a smaller tax cut, and we would have a simplified tax code. What we got out of Congress was a bigger tax cut and a much more complicated tax code. It's going to be easier for most consumers to file, but if you're a business owner, expect to spend a lot of hours trying to figure this out.
No, you just hire a CPA.
Well, even when you have not talked to your CPA lately, but I have. We're spending a lot of hours talking about this.
Yeah, but so what is the practical upshoot for this for you if you're an investor or just a member of the public? It's a couple of things that are true. Number one, the deficit that we're running up right now in the United States through increased spending and reduced revenues is unsustainable. That's simply what the Office of Management and Budget said. We literally will bankrupt ourselves at some point down the road. in the next 30 years if this continues, which means it's going to change. And when it does change, we're going to have to play catch-up. We're going to have to find a way.
There's a tariff on catch-up coming.
There is, I know that. And there'll be a tariff on this, too. We'll have to find some way to reduce expenditures and increase revenues at the same time. Be aware this is a reality that's coming. It's a fiscal reality. You cannot reverse the president nor anybody else can repeal the laws of economics. So we are in boom times right now.
Take advantage of it.
Which means don't spend everything. Don't dump everything. Don't get crazy. Recognize that you need to have a plan for when all this reverses, because it's going to, because it's not sustainable. It's that simple.
And this is, you know, people heard us, hopefully people listening right now heard us in 2008 and 2009 saying, now's the time not to panic. Now's the time to dig in and say, we're about to have a boom time. We're going to have probably a decade of boom time. Well, now we're at the end of that decade. It's not like we've changed our tune. We're not changing it at all. We've said, look, we've had a boom time now. Now prepare for the downtime.
We have been accused of being insatiable optimists during, well, we've been in 2002 and in 2009 and every time the market goes down. And we are. Because there's bargains all over the place out there. But right now we're saying, hey, just because we got a lot of rain doesn't mean the drought's not coming.
Right. So prepare. If you're selling your hay, keep some of it.
And you have been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail on weekends, live people during the week answering the phone. And the telephone number is 254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly. We actually read those things at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. We have recordings of this episode and lots more going back through history. You can read our newsletter, our philosophy, and see our made-for-radio faces and our beautiful staff. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for listening.